Welcome to Scenes, conversations in culture with the people who know it best. I'm your host Lenny, and along with my brilliant producer Ruby, we'll be chatting with guests across music, art, fashion, film, sport and technology in a bid to understand the scenes we love that little bit better. Introducing Dr. Matt Lodder, a lecturer, curator and author of art history who specialises in body art and tattooing. We chatted about his journey into academia, his incredible debut book, Painted People, get a glimpse into history through tattooing, discuss what Jen Alpha's relationship to the art form might look like, and how changing your body changes your relationship with the world.
So can you tell us the first thing you fell in love with and the impact it's had on you later in life?
You know, like, so when I was a kid, so I was born in 1980, I was growing up in the 80s, and I was obsessed with, like, the first thing I was obsessed with was WWF wrestling. So
sick.
I was completely obsessed with, like, The Undertaker in particular. And then also that kind of period of, like, soft rock, like Guns N' Roses and stuff, yeah, that was starting to come over into the UK. And they all had tattoos, and I was just like, tattoos are really cool. Like, I really want to get, a tattoo. Tattoos are so cool. And both my grandparents were like, no, don't do that. And they told me these two stories, right? So my granddad was Dutch. He was a submariner in the Dutch Navy, based out of Jakarta in the Dutch East Indies at the time. And he told me that he was on shore leave one day from his submarine, and he was drunk on his rum ration in a tattoo shop in Jakarta, and they were about to tattoo a fly on the end of his nose, and he woke up just in time. Right. And my granddad's very austere,
yeah,
like very conservative dude, and like just was like, yeah, got away literally with the sort of skin of his teeth kind of thing. And then my nan, who was English but grew up in Australia, she was like, oh yeah, your great-grandma had a tattoo. And I was like, what? So my great-grandma, who was born in about 1880 or so, basically around about the turn of the century, around about 1900, maybe a little bit later, her little brother comes home one day and he says, hey, little sister, can I tattoo you? And she says, will it come off? And he says, yes.
That's great.
Yeah. So apparently she had her initials. Her name was Ethelwyn Darby. She had ED tattooed on her wrist. And again, obviously, like, regretted it. Didn't want it to be there. Apparently, you know, even in the hot Australian summers, kept it covered up. But being told those two stories as a kid just kind of really, like, you know, when you tell a kid not to jump on, yeah, jump in puddles, they go and jump in,
button,
don't,
yeah,
push the red button. And I just completely fell in love with it. And yeah, sort of off to the races. I think a lot of people that get really heavily tattooed have some similar experience, you know, like see someone who's heavily tattooed and just, it's magic when you're a kid, right?
Yeah.
You know, like you just want to try and rub it off, and you can't understand why it doesn't,
yeah,
come off.
I totally relate. It just is so, like, fascinating. Like, so my dad had loads of tattoos growing up, and I just always thought, like, they were not, I guess not in the same way of, like, do not get them, but just, I just thought they were so fascinating.
Yeah.
When you're, like, a little kid. I used to colour them in. And
yeah,
stuff.
Right.
I thought they were so cool.
Did you grow up in New York?
Yeah.
So when were you born? What year?
99.
Oh, my God, you're such a...
I know.
Because I was going to say, because tattooing was banned in New York from, like, 1962 until 1997.
Yeah.
Right, which is... people don't believe that now, because,
yeah,
it's such a mecca of tattoo culture. It's such an important place,
yeah,
in the history of tattooing. But there was no tattooing in the city limits of New York City for, like, yeah, over 30 years. It's amazing.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Obviously, you fell in love with tattoos.
Yeah.
And then that journey from applying that passion to academia, I think to most probably seems like something that's quite unlikely, but you've obviously managed to do it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's been a weird ride, and it wasn't something I set out to do, but it all kind of makes sense in hindsight. So I didn't get tattooed, partly because I was obsessed with tattoos so young that when I started like buying punk records and stuff when I was like 14, 15, coming into London, going to Tower Records, and like next to all the import punk records, they had racks and racks of import tattoo magazines. And I was buying these magazines, and they had all these amazing photos of like just this incredible tattoo work, none of which looked like anything I'd ever seen anyone who I knew was tattooed at the time, you know. And so I sort of was like, I don't want to get tattooed by some local tattooer. I want to get tattooed in America. I need to get this amazing work. And so I sort of avoided getting tattooed too young. And I, you know, I can't draw a straight line, so being a tattoo artist was kind of out of the question. But yeah, I was just really obsessed with it. And my dad said to me when I was about 16, 17, like, oh, no one's going to pay you to read books for a living, right? Because like he's a truck driver, and no one in my family had been to university before, and just didn't really, you know, didn't even think it was a career option. So I went and did a degree in languages. I trained as a professional translator and interpreter. I ended up getting tattooed while I was living abroad for the first time in France, by an American guy, although I literally just got some black stars on my wrist, right? Yeah. So anyone could have done them. I really could have got them done. I bumped into him actually a few years ago, and I was like, you won't remember me, but like, you're the first guy to tattoo me. But yeah, like, and I did a, so, but that was at a time, again, like completely sort of serendipitously, really, like quite luckily. It was at the time, I now know, towards the end of the 90s, when there was this thing in academic humanities called the corporeal turn, right? When all of a sudden lots of different disciplines were getting interested in the body and issues of, you know, body transformation, of plastic surgery was a big issue of interest, lots of performance artists. Yeah. You know, it was sort of at a time when lots of artists were dealing with issues coming out of the AIDS crisis, and so there's this real interest in kind of the body from all these interesting angles. And I did a module in my final year at uni on European cinema. Makes sense for a languages degree, right? But in that, we started reading some of this stuff that was all about, you know, bodies and about how bodies interact with the world. And I was like, oh, this is sort of similar to stuff I was interested in. I was getting interested in piercing and body mod stuff as well. And I ended up doing a master's degree in the body. It was this amazing interdisciplinary course at the University of Reading at the time, which basically every single discipline. So we did like lectures in art history and fine art and philosophy, psychology, cybernetics, theology, literature, that's like sick. All where those disciplines converged on the body, because mm-hmm. it was sort of very trendy at the time. Because I was like, I want to do more of that, you know. And then while I was there, I met the woman who would become my PhD supervisor, and she said to me, like, oh, you should come and do a PhD in art history. And I was like, I don't know anything about art. Like, you know, yeah. I'd barely been to an art gallery. Like, the art that I'd started to fall in love with, actually, and the language I developed around what art was like all these mad performance artists that I didn't even know were artists. Yeah. You know, people like Franco B and Ron Athey, who were sticking fucking swords in their faces and stuff, you know? That was like, oh my God, this is the coolest thing ever. So I was like, that's art, you know, is it? Okay.
Yeah.
And that was it, really, off to the races, you know? Like, I sort of happened to have the, you know, the kind of intellectual interest, the long-standing curiosity. I started, you know, I also happened around that time to walk in, I started getting tattooed, and I'd fallen in love with like old school, like American traditional tattooing, basically from reading all these magazines. And no one at the time was really doing it. That there was one guy in London called Martin Clark, who was an old rockabilly. Obviously, he wasn't even that old. He was a rockabilly guy who was doing all this kind of Sailor Jerry Americana tattooing. And I happened to go into the shop that was tattooed by him, and it turned out that the shop he worked in was owned by this guy. Still there, still is owned by this guy called Lau Hardy, who turns out is this completely influential sort of central figure of like tattooing. And I got to know him, and he put me in touch with loads of people, and I just sort of found myself a little bit in the right place at the right time. Mm-hmm. You know, like it's not quite that simple, but I didn't set out to be like, okay, how can I be a tattoo historian?
Yeah.
But it all came together in a way that, you know, means I have a really particular set of insights and a particular set of access to what I do, you know?
So how are you currently applying that in terms of what you're doing now?
Yeah, well, so I started off like doing stuff that was pretty theoretical and not very, I was just, my PhD was about trying to figure out like whether that term body art makes any sense, really, because it had been thrown around a lot, but no one who actually talks about art in a technical, you know, academic sense, I'd never really thought about whether that metaphor makes any sense, you know, like if it is art, who's the artist, can you hang it on a gallery wall, you know, all these things that sort of, if we take that seriously, become quite interesting questions. But I hadn't really applied it. And then post-PhD, I was sort of getting more into this application of the problem. And since really 2010, so you know, nearly 15 years now, 13, 14 years, I've been basically trying to work on a particular set of histories. I've done lots of exhibitions. I did a big exhibition a couple of years ago at the National Maritime Museum in Cornwall. And I just published a book, which came out in hardback last year and is coming out in paperback at the end of this year, called Painted People.
Yeah.
Which is
very exciting.
Yeah, thank you. Which is like a kind of, it's not really a history of tattooing book, but it's a kind of, I call it history through tattooing, you know?
Yeah.
It's a way of like taking that basic claim of art history, looking at pictures in the past and seeing what they tell us about the people that made them and saw them, and seeing what happens when we do that with tattooing. So yeah, and I get to do lots of mad stuff, travel all over the world, talk to lots of really interesting people. And I just sort of often count myself very fortunate to be doing what I'm doing, you know?
Yeah, of course. What was the process like writing the book? Because am I right in saying, obviously, prior to that, all of the writing you'd done was academic, paper-based?
Yeah.
This was your first foray into kind of popular...
Pretty much. I mean, I'd done some writing for tattoo magazines over the years. And as I said, I'd done this exhibition. But... Yeah, like actually committing it to paper was quite stressful, and we initially wanted to do something that was a lot more illustrated. You know, I wanted to do a lot more, a sort of more of a, you know, picture book, I suppose, so to speak. But it turns out they're really expensive to do, and we got some, and they're really complicated. We got some publishers really interested, and then they just did the sums and were like, we don't think we can make this work.
Yeah.
So basically my agent, a guy called Max, who I'd met through a friend of mine, and the publisher that I ended up working with, William Collins, were like, okay, well, here's a format we think will work. Like, would you be up for it? And initially I was like, well, I don't know. We'll see how it goes. And I'm really pleased with how it ended up, because I ended up with these like 20 kind of historical stories from way longer than I normally look at. Most of my research has been in like 19th and 20th century British and American stuff. The book goes right back to like 5,500 years ago. But yeah, it was really fun to write it, because, you know, like, even the stuff that wasn't straightforwardly in my academic area of interest, and I was a bit nervous about that. I was a bit worried about taking stuff that was not something I'd found out on my own, kind of thing. But I hopefully, you know, when people read the book, there is value in me, like, even reading stuff by, let's say, Egyptologists.
Yeah.
That otherwise is, you know, the stuff that I was reading is aimed at other Egyptologists, and it is kind of inscrutable, very difficult to read if you're not a specialist. You know, it will say the Upper Kingdom or describe some god or whatever, and you're like, oh, I don't know who this is, because they don't need to explain to their audience. But for me, I was, like, trying to explain those, put it in some historical context, and then talk about where this fits into a broader story of tattooing. So I think, hopefully, even in the areas that aren't primary research, as I guess we'd call it, there's some utility there and some interest. And, yeah, weirdly, the only criticisms I've had of the book, you know, the sort of, there was a one-star review on Amazon.
was this on your Twitter?
Yeah, because it didn't have enough pictures.
When we were doing a bit of research... And I was just looking around, your Twitter came up on Google, and that was the first tweet that came up, with this guy being like, not enough pictures.
Yeah. My friend was like, book is too booky.
Yeah.
I was like, well, fair enough. I thought we should have had more pictures too. So, yeah. One, mate. But, you know, the book I'm doing at the moment is half as long and has got a few hundred pictures in it.
Oh.
So that's going to be almost like an illustrated companion.
Yeah.
Nice. Are there any stories in particular that stand out?
There's a few that are really my favourites. I like, especially the ones that go to some really surprising places. I mean, the one that I really enjoyed writing the most, I think, although it didn't have a very satisfying ending, but it's the story of this young girl called Madeleine Altman, who was born towards the end of the 19th century in New York, funnily enough. And she ran away from home in 1906. She lived in Brooklyn, daughter of an insurance salesman. She was about 15, and she ran away from home And they found her a couple of weeks later, like basically like drunk on the Bowery, like in some saloon bar.
Classic.
Yeah, like her pocket stuffed full of love letters from sailors, and she was completely heavily tattooed. And she's in the New York papers for about 3 or 4 days, right? And she comes across as this real sort of gum-chewing, like sassy young New York chick, right? She's like, yeah, I just want to be a sailor boy, or, you know, the boys won't look at you unless you've got a few tattoos. And it's, she seems, she's
never changed.
Yeah, right. She comes across just really sassy and sweet and smart. And she says she's in the paper for a couple of days and then, you know, sort of disappears. But she's interesting because one of the people that is tattoos her, a guy called Samuel O'Reilly, who ends up getting a fine. He's actually one of the most important tattooers in the history of Western tattooing. He's like the first guy to have a patent for a tattoo machine. So she's sort of like that bit of her story sort of known a little bit because she intersects with this more straightforward tattoo history story. But I was like, what happened to her? I want to know what happened to this girl. And in trying to figure out what happened to her, and this is a good kind of illustration of what the book does. I end up telling the story really of what it was like to be a kind of wayward young girl in New York in the early 20th century. So she was picked up by this society called the New York Society for the Protection of Children, which ironically was set up after the New York Society for the Protection of Cruelty to Animals, right? They were inspired. there was a Let's Look After Animals
in a weird
charity.
Order.
Yeah, right. And so this group became really influential in New York, and they were very interested in kind of moral and hygienic crimes, right? So they were interested in stopping young people doing sex work. They were interested in stopping like mail carriers, like paper boys delivering obscene mail. Not in stopping kids working, or yeah. You know, just in stopping them delivering obscene
like a weird,
publications.
Very primitive, like CPS and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, like tattooing is like both of those things, right? It's both a kind of moral transgression and also a physical one. And so they sent her with her parents' encouragement, really. Her parents said they wanted to cure her of her sea madness, right? So she gets sent to this place called the House of Mercy in Inglewood. And it was fucking horrible, right? Like, it was run by nuns. Like, one of the nuns who was there while she was there committed suicide. When they decommissioned it in the 1930s, a New York Times reporter went and found like graffiti on the walls saying like, you know, get me out of here. Some girls had run away, and they, you know, one of them said, I'd rather be eating rats in Central Park than go back to that place. So it was just this horrible, horrible place. And then the stories of other girls that were sent there, another girl who was sent there for being tattooed, another girl was sent there for dancing. They caught her. They found her out dancing, you know, sort of slightly underage on Coney Island. And so, yeah, there's this really horrible, very gendered, very kind of well-meaning but kind of horrible thing. And then I traced her story a little bit through some genealogical records. She got married to a guy who was from quite a posh family down in Texas, but then clearly wasn't really ever welcome into the family because he got remarried, and when he married, there was this huge spread in the El Paso papers, and it was like, you know, great society wedding, and the fact he'd been married before was never really mentioned again. And she sort of vanishes around about the 1920s, and I don't quite know what happened to her. It's very sad, but I felt like, you know, through her story, it starts off with this like, oh cool, tattoos, and then you get somewhere quite socially interesting, you know, all about gender, all about attitudes to health and hygiene, all about all these other things.
I'm sure there must be such an interesting kind of gendered approach to tattooing, because I guess, especially in Western societies, and this might have changed as well, which we'll get to a little bit later, but it has always been seen as a bit of a masculine...
Yeah, well, that's certainly been the kind of cliche, and
it's the stereotype.
Yeah,
I suppose.
And like one of the things I collect, you know, is newspaper accounts saying, "Oh, tattoos are not just for sailors anymore. You know, everyone's doing them." And quite often, that's like, "Oh my God, women are getting tattooed now."
Yeah,
can you imagine? And that's been going. You know, those headlines have been around since the 19th century. I mean, you know, tattooing has been like predominantly male in a Western context. And predominantly kind of let's say, working class, yeah, there or thereabouts. But, you know, the reason we have a tattoo industry, for example, is because rich people wanted to get tattooed and were willing to pay money to strangers to get tattooed. And there have been plenty of, you know, there was speaking of New York, around the same time as actually as Madeline was getting tattooed, there was this woman in New York called Amy Crocker, who was like one of the richest women in the world. She was the judge, daughter of this judge, and they called her the Queen of Bohemia, and she was just like, just loved being outrageous,
right?
Oh my
and
God.
she'd been tattooed in Japan, and she had a huge snake on her arm, and she went and got her boyfriend's name on her arm, and a big freaking demon head tattooed on her arm.
Sounds quite cool.
She's so cool. Yeah. her autobiography is called "And I Do It Again." Yeah, she's an amazing woman because she was rich. She could get away with it.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Like it was sort of treated as eccentric.
You see that now, I guess, yeah, in socialites, like the outlandish kind.
That's it. And the other story that I tell in the book. So she's one story. Amy is. There's another story in the book of a woman, and I say woman. Like, it's difficult to kind of properly gender her, but I go with woman and use female pronouns because that's what her biographers do. But she was also like, she was called Jo Carstairs, born Marion Carstairs, changed her name to Jo, dressed very manly, said once in an interview, "I came out of the womb queer," right? And she was again one of the richest women in the world. She was the granddaughter of a trustee of the Standard Oil Company. Her like mother was a lady-in-waiting to the Queen of England.
Oh, God.
And she was like, fuck it, I'm going to become a powerboat racer.
Yeah.
So she became, like, literally, like, the world's fastest powerboat racer.
And that's amazing.
And rather than getting all these pretty, like, feminine kind of, yeah, oriental tattoos like Amy, she just got whacking great sailor tattoos on, yeah, her arms. Was outwardly, like, dating women. Mm-hmm. There's a story about her going to dinner with Marlene Dietrich, who she was having an affair with at the time. And she turned up in a tuxedo, right? Yeah. And they were like, "You can't come to this party like in a dress and a tuxedo. You need to go and put a dress on. You're a woman." So she went away and put a dress on, which showed off all her tattoos. And they were like, no, go back and put the tuxedo. Go back and put the tuxedo on. But she was using... Again, her story is super interesting because one of her mother's... husbands, one of her stepfathers was this guy called Serge Voronoff, who was a French-Russian like endocrinologist who was like pioneering. Basically, he was like transplanting monkey testicles into people to try and make them more virile.
Oh.
Yeah, turns out it doesn't really work.
But no shit.
They thought at the time it would make you more manly and more masculine. So Joe, you know, is interested in this kind of gender queerness and clearly interested in masculinity, changes her name to a male name, and is raised in this context where that's clearly something that's around her as she's growing up. So yeah, like her, you know, her story. She also ended up having a private army and owning an island in the Bahamas.
Oh my God.
Completely incredible woman.
Jeez.
But like, again, so from this one story of this, again, this sort of eccentric figure, yeah, we get to stories about histories of gender, histories of queerness, history, yeah, of transness, how like trans people even today are using tattooing to like negotiate their gender identities. Yeah. Like, you know, basically I think a lot of the time, and I'm really indebted to lots of amateur tattoo, I say amateur, I don't mean that in any way disparagingly, but like lots of work being done in tattoo history is done by tattooers, mm-hmm, really, or families of tattooers, people who have access to amazing material and have a huge amount of knowledge, but aren't professional historians. And they produce amazing books, but they're always very narrowly focused on the biographies of, yeah, the people they're writing about, which is great. And as I said, they do work that I could never do. But what I see my job as is to take that amazing knowledge, which tells a much more complex and rich story of tattooing than is usually present in the mainstream media and certainly in the mainstream historical record, and like, you know, put it in bigger contexts. Mm-hmm. So yes, what is not just what's interesting about tattooing itself, what does that tell us about all these other things?
Mm-hmm. In your experience, sort of, and in your research, do you think there's been kind of an impact of tattooing? I guess tattooing is different everywhere, I suppose, and maybe I'm just looking at it in a very, like, US and UK kind of focus, but kind of moving from being something that's quite counterculture to something that's quite mainstream to do nowadays?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's been the kind of, like, certainly been the cliche, but I've found, you know, like the first professional tattooer in London, the guy who claims to have coined the word tattooist, although he didn't really, but he certainly claims to have done, Cogger Sutherland MacDonald, like, he was saying in, like, the 1880s, oh, like, I preferred towing and it was underground. Right. It's too popular now.
Yeah, see, it's always going to be like that.
Yeah.
You know, so in like 20 years, it's going to be like, it. Oh, so back in, you know, the 2020s when it was underground.
And I see that. And I've seen that in my own career. You know, I've been doing this, as I said, now for like 15, 16 years. And I've been saying the same thing for more than a decade. I do, as I said, track these headlines. And it's kind of funny. I do a whole talk with them. And you sort of start. You can always start like more or less in the present, right? Whenever I'm giving the talk, and you can just go back and you can just find them. Like, you know, there's my favorite, some of my favorite ones, one from 1908, where the headline in the New York Times was, tattooing is not confined to semen only, which I like. And they use the pun headline, tattooing is not uncommon. Right, which is good. There was an article in Vanity Fair magazine in 1926 where the author of that basically says, tattooing has moved from the savage to the sailor, from the sailor to the landsman, and is now to be found beneath many a tailored shirt. Right, that's 100 years ago. And in that article, they interview a guy who's like, I'm a real artist and I do beautiful tattoos, but all kids today want is diving girls.
Yeah.
You know? That's 100 years ago. In the 1980s, like 1982, there was an article in London in City Life magazine where it says something like, if you think, you know, tattoos are all to do with sailors and hepatitis, you're out of date, and all kinds of people are doing it, including university lecturers.
Yeah.
You know? So, but the truth is, right, obviously, that said, tattooing is definitely now visible and definitely now more socially acceptable in Western contexts than it ever has been. That's certainly the case, right?
You move, like, in a, maybe in a, like, traditionally corporate setting, it's not uncommon to maybe see people with visible...
That's right.
...tattoos.
Yeah. So that's, you know, it's still the case that if you've got tattoos very visibly, you're going to have a harder time in some careers. There was a really interesting survey over the summer in the UK which revealed that, like, Gen Zers are more sceptical of tattoos in the workplace than Gen Xers and millennials are.
I read that and I was going to ask, because I'm very intrigued about how Gen, like, because I'm Gen Z, but even how, like, Gen Alpha?
It's wow, like, what's next? I have no idea what's next.
I think it's
Gen Alpha's next. It's like people who were born, I think, after, like, 2005, maybe, how they're going to approach it and whether it's going to be more of a, like, maybe something akin to, like, Gen X, which is a bit, like, hedonistic, getting tattoos, or if it's going to be a bit more, like, restrained about.
Yeah, well, I think the overall story is, right, like, tattooing is now more popular than ever and more visible than ever, but it's still... It is still countercultural. Like, I've been saying, you know, I did a talk beginning my career about how, you know, various kings of England used to be tattooed, and some tattooist came up to me afterwards and she said, like, half jokingly, like, I wish you wouldn't say that because, like, I make my living because 18-year-olds think tattooing's edgy, right? And if, like, but I'm not, when I say that, like, you know, tattooing's always been this hot new thing or always been no longer for sailors anymore, I think that the fact that cliche's been around for so long tells you the opposite story, right? That there is something about it that is kind of troubling to mainstream life. And no matter how visible and how popular it gets, there is a kind of stripe of people who just don't get it and don't like it. And I think it's so... Tattooing is so transgressive to lots of things we take for granted in our mainstream cultural context, right? So, like, being touched by a stranger, willingly undergoing pain, like, messing with our relationship to time and fashion in a confusing way. Like, all of those things are quite profound. And so I think we're going to end up, you know, probably with me saying the same shit for the rest of my career. But, you know, but going back to, like, Gen Z, I think weirdly that poll sort of proved my thesis a little bit more, because I think, you know, that generation, it seems to me, are a bit more conservative in lots of ways than the generation of them, and for interesting good reasons. A lot of it to do with economic precarity, and if you're worried about getting a job and so many things that can make it difficult, if you're deliberately making that harder for yourself, I can understand why an instinct of a young teenager raised in this kind of liberal get what you deserve kind of mindset would think, well, yeah, tattooing is probably not a professional thing to be doing.
I wonder if social media has any impact on it in a way that like tattooing is kind of the OG like permanent physical evidence of something, and like I know a lot of younger people who grew up with access to social media like since they were like 11 or 12, there is that kind of digital footprint that you grow up thinking about.
Yeah,
I wonder if that ever translates to permanent tattooing.
I think so. I mean, I was online very early, so I got a modem for my 15th birthday in 1995. Yeah. One of the first things I was doing was like going on before the sort of visual internet existed. It was all sort of text based like Usenet groups about tattooing and stuff. And through that I met a lot of people, and it was very foundational for me. There's some good, interesting, and I sort of believe it, that MySpace and then certainly Instagram have been responsible for, at least in part, why there's more visible tattooing now. Mm-hmm. Facial and hand tattooing, because that's what's visible in your profile picture. If you want to be visibly tattooed, you need to be tattooed in more visible places, so to speak. But I think this anxiety about permanence, that's really interesting. I hadn't thought about that before, but it makes a lot of sense that if young people are worried about the permanence of their decisions. I mean, I think the other thing that happened, obviously, in the last decade or so, 20 years or so, is lasering. And lasering is a lot better than it used to be. And you can, tattoos are sort of less permanent in a way.
That was going to be my next question about kind of what do you think, I think it was on YouGov, there was some sort of poll or statistic about there's been quite a rise in tattoo removals.
Yeah, that's true.
Tattoos feel less of a permanent thing. Because I think you're right about the process of lasering. Not that I've ever had a tattoo removed. I know when I started getting tattoos, I think my mum was like, it's really painful to remove. It's torture.
I hear that. I haven't had any lasers either. I've had friends who've had huge whole body suits lasered off. Crazy. I just know, tattoo removal has been something that people have been doing for a long time. I'm very glad we have lasers compared to what they used to do back in the 1920s and stuff.
I don't know if I want to know what they did back then.
Well, the first real thing that caught on was like this thing called tannic acid, which is basically a kind of silver alloy, and you tattoo it in and it would basically turn into a big black scar, and then you'd then that would come out. There was a guy, I talk about this in the book a little bit, there was a guy in Germany called Christian Varlick, and tattooing was very taboo in Germany. The Nazis didn't like tattooing. This in more detail in the book, but a lot of the stigma against tattooing and the link with criminality comes from German and European criminology. But the Nazis didn't really like tattooing at all, with the one exception of SS members having blood type tattoos on their armpits. But Varlick, who was a tattooer in Hamburg, had developed this way of removing them. And you'd go to Varlick, he'd put this like tincture on, wrap your tattoo up for a couple of days, and then he'd be able to literally peel the tattoo off.
No.
And there's photos of it, like, in the archive in Hamburg, of him, like, peeling this tattoo away from the skin. And it would be preserved as a skin specimen, so it would keep the tattoo, like, almost as a, almost like a piece of paper. And that recipe had been lost to time. He died, with his secret. But it turned out that one of his patients had got an infection, and the Nazis government had sent round a inspector and be like to find out what's going on. And he'd given the authorities his recipe, which is a kind of particular mix of solvent. And my colleague, another tattoo historian in Germany, a guy called Ole Whitman, like found the recipe, recreated it, and tested it out on pigskin, and it still worked.
Really?
So, those are a bit more brutal. than what we've got now. And lasering, you know, even in the last, I said in the last few years, has got really come along a long way. But you still shouldn't be treating tattoos as if they're anything other than permanent. You know.
Well, I guess if in kind of like a trend forecasty kind of way, not that tattoos are a trend, but I there's been quite a rise in like solid temporary tattoos or like semi-permanent tattoos that aren't just like the ones that you get at like a kid's birthday party.
Yeah.
Stick the hot water on it, it rubs off with just like warm water. But people getting like tattoos that fade over time or using different kinds of ink. And I'm just curious if you think that the like the way that we see tattooing now, if that might change with the sort of like rise of maybe people getting semi-permanent, even if that's even possible, or like temporary tattoos becoming quite a normal thing to do. And
yeah, I mean, that kind of people have been sort of talking about this kind of temporary tattoo stuff for a long time. And of course, like some forms of tattoo like technology, like, you know, microblading, for example, are sort of temporary in a way, right? So the way a tattoo works basically is you have to hit the right layer of skin, which is the middle layer of your dermis, and the ink particles are absorbed by or encompassed by the immune cells because they're too big to remove through your immune system, which is why tattoos work. It's basically particles of ink that are too big for your immune system to remove. What happens with those temporary tattoos is really they're just done in the shallowest layer of skin, so they your body sloughs off that skin and that skin is removed and those ink particles come out and fade rather than being reabsorbed into the immune system. I think what that means is you end up with a tattoo that looks really shit for most of the time. And it will probably never completely fade because some of those needle pricks are going to get into the layer which keeps that permanently. And people have been talking about this for a long time, and I think more or less a myth, because even if it did work, it would be awful. Like, it would look terrible. That said, you know, there are some interesting things happening at the moment. I mean, there's been lots of people, again, for decades, trying to like develop creams that would remove tattoos or fade tattoos, skin bleaching agents and things. None of them are really caught on. There's a really amazing thing that's in the works at the moment. There's a studio in New York run by a guy called Bang Bang. He tattoos a lot of celebrities and some really incredible artists in that studio. Really, like, you know,
his studio does quite a lot of the fine line. I know West 4th or something does a lot of the very delicate.
Yeah, they've just the artists that they've got that work in. Like, there's a lot of, you know, a lot of tattooers are very sniffy and have been for decades about tattooers that, you know, market themselves as celebrity tattooers. Mm. That's been a kind of bugbear of the tattoo industry for a very long time. But, like, you know, Bang Bang, who, full disclosure, I occasionally write visa letters to help for his artists to kind of, you know, for them to come to the US. But he, along with some scientists, have been working on this thing that they call magic ink. So when you get radiology, often you're tattooed with a little dot to target precisely the laser, right? But obviously a lot of people who are getting that done don't really want to have tattoos on them. So these radiologists were trying to think of ways that they could, you know, mitigate that. And they developed this particular pigment, which when you fire a certain frequency of light at it, it changes colour. And basically they managed to create this tattoo that you can turn on and off. And Bang Bang realised that there were some artistic uses of this rather than just medical ones, and I think basically has the patent on it and has started to develop it and is starting very soon to roll it out. And he's put some of it on his Instagram, and basically, yeah, like, the way it works is you can have a tattoo on you that's red and you can shine a light on it and it will disappear, and then you shine a light on it again just from a torch and it will come back.
I could imagine that would be massive for, like, photography shoots.
Yeah.
Stuff like that.
Really crazy. I mean, you know, I've even heard about, like, professional magicians thinking about interesting things that they want to do with it. I won't say who, but I bumped into someone while I was on my honeymoon who worked with a big-name magician and was like, yeah, we were there talking to them about some stuff. So, you know, I think, like, it's super cool. I doubt that'll ever catch on as a mainstream thing. I imagine it's really fucking expensive.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, you know, I think the beautiful thing about tattooing, in a way, you know, the first chapter in the book is a tattoo that was done 5,500 years ago, so 3,500 years BCE. And it's basically more or less the same as a tattoo done now. You create a wound in the skin and you find a way of getting ink particles in it. And, like, really nothing much has changed, honestly, in the technology to do that. So I think there's a great quote that this guy called Milton Zeiss, who was a tattoo supplier back in the 1920s and 30s and 40s, said, which was, you know, tattooing is as ancient as time and as modern as tomorrow. And I think that kind of sums it up for me, right? Like, you've got a tattoo, it's going to be with you forever, it's going to be with you tomorrow as well. And yeah, like, that for me is the beauty of it. You know, it connects to these deep histories, but it's also always super exciting, and yeah, it's going to be around, well, you know, again, as I quote in the book, for life plus 6 months, you know, we'll die. And we'll
That's something to think about.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Whenever you get a tattoo, you don't think much about it.
there's a chapter in the book about these tattooed mummies from Siberia, from this cultural group called the Pazaric. Every mummy that we found from that culture, male and female, have been tattooed. They're from about 300 BCE, so about a million and a half ago. But archaeologists who've studied them, some of them, they reckon, like, the same person tattooed some of them. So, like, one tattoo artist, their work has survived for 1,500 years. You know,
that's one hell of a portfolio.
One hell of a portfolio, right?
Yeah.
How would you describe your own canvas?
Yeah.
I don't know, man. Like, part of me wishes that I had more space, because there's so many good artists now. Like, as I said, like, I very pointedly didn't want to get tattooed by people locally to me when I was a kid, a teenager. But now there's incredible, like, even in, like, little shops in tiny towns, there's just, I mean, there's still lots of shitty tattooers around there, don't get me wrong, but there's so many good artists now. And so part of me wishes I had a bit more spare space. I mean, I still have got my back pretty empty, so I'm looking forward to getting a big back piece soon. I think for me, I now, like, don't really think about getting tattooed. When I get tattooed, it's very spur of the moment. I get tattooed by friends and people that I meet, and I'm less, you know, I really agonised over those first ones, you know, and now I don't, and that's quite liberating.
That's such a common, like, once you get one.
Yeah, it doesn't really matter once you get one.
You just want to get another.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I would say I'm very honoured and grateful that I've been able to meet so many great people, and that people trust me with things, and I can be this kind of conduit for knowledge from the community into the world. And yeah, like, as I said, I find myself in a very lucky, strange position, but I'm very glad of it, you know.
I had a friend that wrote a dissertation on people who are transgender or are non-binary, who either undergo gender reassignment surgery or just physically, or don't undergo the surgery, but, like, physically transition or just whatever, in whatever way they see fit, and their relationship with the kind of the body and tattooing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm just, that's so fascinating, because there's a lot about people who do transition or, like, reconsider their gender in any kind of capacity, whether that's, like, becoming non-binary or whatever, having these relationships with, like, the body and the tattoo. And I was just wondering if you've had any sort of, I know you spoke a little bit about.
Yeah. So the chapter's slightly about that, right? So, I'm interested, I mean, in general, I think, and this was something I even was starting to do in my master's degree dissertation, which is sort of the first time I started thinking about this stuff academically. A lot of that was around, I had trans friends and friends with trans parents, like, back in the 90s. And so, and as I said, like, you know, this was a time when, like, Gender Trouble by Judith Butler had come out in 91, and it was a big, thinking about the body in relationship to kind of gender and social presentation was a big part of my way into this problem in general anyway. And I'm really interested in, like, how, not just how, like, the standard conversation about tattooing is often that tattoos reveal something about yourself, you know, and there's a positive version of that, more kind of postmodern, you know, like I'm just tearing my, you know, reclaim my body, or I'm telling them some truth about myself. There's a negative version of that as well, which comes from like criminology, which is that we can tell on your body what a terrible person you are by the tattoos you've got. And I don't really subscribe to either of those two simplistic reductive things, because I think what actually happens when you change your body, whether it's permanently or sort of semi-permanently, whether it's through tattooing or gender affirming surgery or all kinds of other things, is you end up in this kind of creative, you know, step forward. So you're creating a new kind of body. You're changing a relationship to the world when you're tattooed. I mean, people who are heavily tattooed or visibly tattooed will get this. You understand how you interact with the world differently, how people view you differently, how things change, and you sort of, your relationship with the world around you, with the society in which you live, has changed. And I think that's the real beauty of it, for specifically for trans people, because they can use those tattoos to, like, you know, create as well as reveal. And I think that's quite powerful. And there's lots of, I cite in the book a couple of people in this recent collection of essays by trans writers who talk about their transition experiences, and several of them talk about their tattooing in that exact way. And there's a sort of flip side of it, which is, again, I looked back at some of the histories and through some trans magazines from the 70s and 80s, and occasionally you'd have trans women writing in and saying, like, I've got tattoos and I want to get rid of them because I don't feel pretty, I don't feel feminine. There was even a story that I cite in the book that I found in an interview with a psychosexologist who was doing some sort of very early trans work back in the 70s, and basically said, oh yeah, I met this patient who had tattoos, and I said, like, they'll never make a convincing woman, so I refused to transition them. It's horrifying, right? So yeah, again, and then there was also stories, again, like, difficult to know exactly how they reflect reality, but these are the stories in the medical journals of, you know, people who were, like, trans women who were being expected to desist from their transitions, and who were, by the account of their doctors at least, kind of becoming hyper-masculine as a response. You know, I'm going to tattoo myself to prove how manly I am. So yeah, I think, like, again, this creativity of tattooing and the production of new kinds of bodies, I think, is a really interesting thing. And like, Jo Carstairs is a great example of that. You know, like, she wasn't going to get pretty feminine, quote unquote, tattoos. She was getting these, like,
like, you know, sailor navy,
which again, I think if people are tattooed, it feels very obvious in a way, very straightforward, but it's not something that's often in the literature, and certainly not in the academic work on this stuff, you know.
If you could describe the tattoo scene in three words,
oh God,
what three words would you choose?
Well, I'm a historian. That's a good question. I mean, like, I always say to people, don't ask me about the present, right, or the future, because I'm a historian.
Yeah.
And I'm also 42 years old. I don't know. I guess, like, I have to say exciting. I'm so thrilled about all the cool shit that people are doing, like, now. Super, super exciting. Conservative. Weirdly, I think tattooing is a very conservative industry, for good and for ill, and protective of itself and cautious about change. And that's interesting and probably surprising to people on the outside. And I guess, you know, from the third one, I just think it's fascinating, and it's something that, as I said, I have just found just endless things to be excited and interested in. And it's taken me all over the world, and I've ended up learning so much through it. And every day, really, I'm discovering new stuff about, you know, and even, you know, just this week, woman in Scotland put up on Facebook, like, oh, I just found this in my loft, and it was like this 100-year-old stash of amazing, like, tattoo stuff from a tattoo we didn't really know much about, hadn't really heard of, and all these amazing drawings and things. And, like, stuff like that's happening all the time, and every single thing like that is a new data point, a new kind of insight into a new set of stories. And that's what keeps me going. There's so much out there, like, behind closed doors, under sleeves. And I'm just really excited to, you know, always excited to be pulling it up. And, like, every day I'm like, oh, fucking hell, that's so cool.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm very lucky that but my job is basically showing other people that stuff and going, look at this stuff.
It's really cool. it's culture, it's interesting. It's just so like culturally enriching, yeah.
Yeah, and people have a very narrow idea of towing, right? Because as we've talked about, those cliches are very persistent. And in some sense, it's quite easy for me to go, hey, look, you know, did you know there was this huge scene of tattooing amongst gay men? No, of course you didn't, because they didn't ever show anybody, right? But now here are the pictures, and look at these beautiful tattooed bumholes or penises, you know, for example. But there's so much more tattooing going on and has been going on than anyone realises. And it's that disjunction between what people think they know about tattooing and what, I'm not saying the truth, really, it's not a bit reductive, but what the actual more rich story is. And that's what I get to do in my job. You know, I get to kind of work with the presupposition and work with the reality and figure out how they fit together.
Yeah.
Super fun. And thank you for having me on to try and do some of the same thing.
No, of course. So you mentioned earlier that you're working on another book. Is there anything else on the horizon?
Yes. Well, that book, we're currently sort of figuring out what the title is going to be. It's sort of provisionally called The Untold History of Tattooing, but that's a bit lame. So we're going to try and think of something else. That's going to be coming out on Yale University Press hopefully in the autumn. The paperback of Painted People is coming out in September. I am doing some talks, depending on when this comes out, I'm doing some talks in London at the Last Tuesday Society and at the Bishopsgate in April. I am doing some talks up in Newcastle, up at Cockersnook Tattoo. And I am doing lots more work. I helped get a huge collection of tattoo history acquired at the National Museum of Wales. There's a huge collection that I didn't quite discover it. It was known about a bit before, but I brought it out of its hiding in a way for my exhibition, and I ended up persuading the government that it was an art historically important collection of national importance. And so it was bought by the nation. So HMRC and tax money basically bought that collection, kept it intact. It's now at the National Museum of Wales, and I'm going to be doing lots more work with that over the coming months and years.
Is that Jesse Knight?
Jesse Knight,
I saw the article earlier this week, was it?
So we did a little feature on it for the Nashville Welsh telly this week, because they were talking about it and trying to sing it. They're digitising it all, it's going to be online. Such a great collection, such a good collection. I was down there a few weeks ago. And I've got a podcast called Beneath the Skin with my mate Tom, where we talk about some of the stuff we've been talking about today, just sort of linking tattooing up with other things. Always doing loads of stuff. I mean, I've always got more on than I've got time to do, so.
Yeah. Well, look, your passion's infectious.
Oh, thank you.
And also your knowledge is eye-opening.
Thank you.
As you mentioned earlier, I think people have a very closed-minded or specific view on tattooing, and I think, you know, all you've got to do is listen to this podcast to blow that misconception wide open.
Yeah, like, I think... you know, like all of that romance, all that love, all of that weirdness, all of that sexiness, all that danger is all still there. I just never want to limit any of that stuff. But yeah, tattooing is this like story of everybody, right? And that's what I find so exciting about it now.
Matt, thank you so much for spending this time with us. How do I even begin to try and wrap that up in a closing statement? Enlightening, powerful, considerate, colourful. It's been an absolute joy. If you haven't already, please check out Matt's book, Painted People, and his brilliant podcast, Beneath the Skin. As always, there are links in the description to everything he mentioned. Until next time.